Hey, it's Dallas, and I have a question for you. Let's imagine you've just taken on a new role as a high-powered executive, and you're in charge of leading a team of, let's say, 30 people within the company. This could be a software development company, a sales organization, a healthcare startup, whatever, it doesn't really matter. But it's you inheriting a group of people that you didn't hire, and you don't even really know anything about. So one of the first things you do in your new role is hire one of those fancy consultancies to perform a 360 review of each of your team members.
Whoa!
And as part of this review, the consultancy has to meet with each team member to assess things like their social skills, their core competency, hard skills, soft skills, past work performance, and all of those things. So this consultancy comes back to you and gives you a list of your top performing employees. Now, these are the employees they've decided are the most likely to overachieve in the upcoming year. These are the employees that are most likely to accept your training, acquire new skills, complete more projects, and produce at an overall higher level of work than their cohorts. So my question is really more of a thought exercise this time. So you've been given this list of 6 to 8 employees that the consultancy believes are going to be your star employees. So how does this impact your overall management style? Do you manage these 6 to 8 employees differently? What about the other 20-ish employees who didn't show up on that list of top performers? Do you suddenly manage those people differently throughout the year? So I want you to take a second and think about how you'd approach this. Okay, so fast forward a year, and guess what? The employees that were identified as the likely top performers actually were. So congratulations to you, congratulations to the consultancy. Job well done, everybody. But what if I told you the consultancy didn't actually do anything? And I don't mean didn't do anything in the way consultants kind of just don't do anything anyway. But what if I told you that if you started with your same 30 employees, you randomly selected a different group of employees and called those ones your potential top performers, that at the end of the year, this new randomly selected group of individuals, they would have then been your top performers. So that can't be right, right? Like, that would undermine everything we think about assessments and reviews, our own candidate selection processes, our own ability to coach, manage, and foster talent. But I mean, there's a lot of research that would suggest that when people, which means employees, students, athletes, when they're pre-selected to be future high performers or low performers, they're far more likely to actually become whatever that designation is than had they not been designated as that thing in the first place. So there's definitely something interesting happening here. So I want to take a quick break and then we'll dive in. This is Dallas McLaughlin and you're listening to Unconsidered, the podcast where we get inside the mind of the modern entrepreneur, business owner, and marketer.
Greed, for lack of a better word, is good.
If you don't know which door to open, always account for variable change.
There is a 0% chance.
You dropped 150 grand on a fucking education, could have got for $1.50 in late charges.
Tell me something I don't already know.
Come on, we just made the deal of our lifetimes. We should celebrate.
We are in a completely fraudulent system.
It's easy for Gazi, it's a wazi, it's a woozy, it's a
fairy dust. It doesn't exist.
Okay, so the question I open this episode with is based on research conducted by Robert Rosenthal and Lenore Jacobson in 1968. Their study, which I think has a pretty cool name, is referred to as the Pygmalion in the Classroom experiment. So that strange name, Pygmalion, the name comes from Pygmalion, the Greek sculptor. So he was a sculptor who fell in love with his own creation, a statue that he had carved. So the Pygmalion in the Classroom experiment was focused on trying to understand how a teacher's own expectations of his or her students actually impacts their academic performance. Basically, it's a study on expectations and, spoiler alert, the self-fulfilling nature of those expectations. So at the beginning of the school year, researchers administered an IQ test to elementary school students to identify the students who were quote-unquote academic bloomers, or those that were expected to have a significant intellectual growth spurt during the school year. So, quick side note here. If you have young students in your home, you know that this is actually a thing that happens. Except, instead of IQ tests, this is done through what we refer to as standardized testing. And it's this weird mechanism schools use to sort kids into specific classes at an extremely young age. So keep this side note in the back of your mind as we go through this episode. So Rosenthal and Jacobson didn't actually sort any students based on the results of an IQ test, or a standardized test for that matter. They just randomly selected about 20% of the students and informed the teachers that these were the students who were the academic bloomers, and that this group of students showed amazing potential in their testing, potential for intellectual development throughout the upcoming school year. So, just to clarify, the selected students were not identified based on any special criteria. It was just a purely randomized test. But at the end of the school year, the researchers found that the students labeled as academic bloomers showed significantly higher intellectual development compared to their peers, the other 80% of the class, who were not randomly selected and artificially labeled as these academic bloomers. So what happened? So what happened is the teachers' own expectations of these academic bloomers influenced their own behaviors, their own teaching methods, which resulted in increased interaction, more support, and more encouragement for the quote-unquote bloomers, and less interaction and less encouragement for the non-bloomers. The difference in the academic performance of these students was not due to any inherent differences in their technical abilities, in their intelligence, their ability to learn, their home environments, or anything of that nature, or even in their own classrooms. They all were in the same classrooms with the same teacher. Remember, they were just randomly labeled on a sheet of paper at the start of the school year and shown to the teacher. The difference in the students' performance was entirely a result of the teacher's own beliefs and the teacher's behavior that was predetermined by that random label completely artificially assigned at the start of the school year. The teachers believed that a certain group of students would result in their own highest and best work, a better reflection of themselves, their highest return on investment, and they focused their attention on those students. So the Pygmalion in the Classroom study demonstrated that teachers' own expectations, whether positive or negative, can have a significant impact on a student's academic performance. This study highlighted the self-fulfilling nature of expectations and how they can shape the trajectories of individuals, particularly in an educational setting. This study by Rosenthal and Jacobson has had a lasting influence on educational psychology and has been cited in numerous subsequent studies and discussions on the Pygmalion effect. It emphasizes the importance of recognizing and managing expectations to create a positive and supporting learning environment for all students. But the findings of the study really have much broader applications beyond education. Understanding the Pygmalion effect and understanding how it's impacting all of us can help us understand and reconcile how our own expectations can and are influencing our outcomes in all sorts of contexts, including our own personal outcomes, our relationships, our businesses, and our workplaces. Okay, so whether you're like me, a sole proprietor of a single-person business, or maybe you're running a small startup, or maybe you're even a cog in a 500-person organization, the Pygmalion effect is impacting you every single day. So let's start with the obvious, where this whole episode started. Put simply, managers who have high expectations for their team members are likely to see improved performance from their team members. Just like in the classroom with academic bloomers and non-bloomers, when leaders express confidence in their employee abilities, and this confidence is demonstrated through increased interactions and support, those team members are shown to perform at a higher level. But this goes both ways. Leaders who lack confidence in their team members, who routinely walk around with that doom and gloom attitude, constantly threatening and demeaning their team members, these leaders will naturally create a team of low performers who have no motivation to perform and are unlikely to try to increase their overall production and skill level, which perpetuates the whole cycle. And we've all been on the receiving end of this and know that to be true. We don't need this study to prove that. But not only does the Pygmalion effect influence team morale, it can influence decisions related to employee development. Leaders with high expectations of a team member communicate more effectively. They provide constructive feedback and consistently offer guidance for improvement, just like our teachers in the classroom. This fosters a culture of continuous learning and development. If a leader has low expectations of an employee, they're not going to invest the same level of effort in providing feedback or guidance to that employee. And this reminds me of something Randy Pasch said as he gave the last lecture, which, paraphrased, was him basically saying, you know, when you're screwing up and nobody says anything to you about it, that means they've given up on you. The people who continuously provide feedback and criticism are often the ones telling you they still love you and care about you, and they just want to make you better. You should actually just go watch that. In a similar vein, the Pygmalion effect can influence decisions related to employee promotions. When a CEO sees an employee who they believe has what it takes to move up in an organization, it's far more likely that that employee will receive additional training and opportunities for advancement. This creates the common trope of the highly qualified, tenured employee getting passed over for a promotion that instead goes to the less qualified, less experienced candidate who seems to just be the favorite employee of the boss. This would be the perfect example of the sculptor falling in love with their sculpture. As individuals, it also impacts us as the expectations that we set for ourselves has a major impact on our own performance. Leaders who set high standards for their own achievements, who hold themselves accountable to a high degree of responsibility and performance, are far more likely to they themselves achieve a higher level of performance, attaining more accolades, and advancing their own careers and businesses much further than they otherwise would have. So that also goes to say that if you really don't expect much out of yourself, that's exactly what you'll get. Again, this makes me think of another famous quote, this one by Kurt Vonnegut, which reads, "We are what we pretend to be, so we must be careful about what we pretend to be." So zooming in further from how the Pygmalion effect impacts organizations to go deeper into the individual, when employees believe that their ideas are valued and that they have a support of the leadership, and this support is clearly articulated up and down the organization, unsurprisingly, team members are far more likely to contribute creatively to problem solving and innovation, which then snowballs into the culture or the very DNA of the organization. This even impacts our own personal relationships. In romantic relationships, studies show us that people tend to behave more like their partner's expectations of them. If one person expects their partner to treat them well and do their share of the housework, for example, the Pygmalion effect tells us that both partners will probably change their behavior to reciprocate that expectation. And like our previous examples, that cuts both ways. Partners who have low expectations of each other create these sort of downward spirals for each other, creating toxic environments and toxic relationships. Okay, so now we have a pretty clear understanding of how expectations, good or bad, can create this sort of self-fulfilling prophecy, bringing those expectations to life. But as with all of these things, we learn about them one day, and then it's noon on a Wednesday, you're buried in meetings, you realize you and your team are way behind on multiple deadlines, and we forget all about all of this stuff. So what are the key points that we need to keep top of mind? It might sound cliche, but it really starts with fostering a positive and inclusive workplace culture where employees feel valued, supported, and encouraged. One where you're promoting open communication and collaboration with the expectation that it will produce a higher level of work. Remember, the expectations are everything. Also, somewhere on this cliche spectrum, you, as a leader, absolutely have to display a positive mindset. You have to show resilience. You need to lead through example and exude confidence backed by a strong work ethic. Your behavior sets the tone for the organization. It influences how your employees approach their own challenges and opportunities. Next, you, again, as the leader that all of these people look to, have to acknowledge and celebrate their achievements within the organization. It's not all about you. We learned during this research that the recognition reinforces the positive expectations you have for your team. And since people tend to rise to these higher expectations, this recognition actually encourages continued growth and excellence. And as that talent level grows, and as you win more awards and your team's overall achievements grow endlessly, you have to ensure that the tools, the support, and the resources your team has access to are always growing at a relative rate. So this includes access to new tools, bringing in outside training, building a supportive work environment, because as people are challenged to grow, as they're challenged to innovate, as they reach new heights, they're bound to make mistakes. And these mistakes or challenges, they need to be framed as opportunities for learning and development and used as moments to ingrain a growth mindset into the very DNA of your team, where these challenges are used to increase the resilience and the innovation within the organization. This kind of resilience creates what Nassim Taleb describes as anti-fragility. This is when organizations are strengthened, not weakened by adversity. Lastly, you absolutely have to assess the impact of your leadership style on your team all the time. You have to be willing to adapt and adjust your approach based on the feedback and the evolving expectations. Because what's working for your team today may not work a month from now. High-performing teams often outpace their leader, which ironically is actually a symptom of a high-functioning leader. The best teams I've ever led have been loaded with talent I couldn't ever touch because that wasn't my job. My job, and now your job as a leader, is to foster this talent, support it, grow it, mentor it, challenge it, praise it, recognize it, encourage it, push it, and mold today's practitioners into tomorrow's leaders. Leaders who will carry on the tradition of managing a team of innovators, creators, and makers who rise up to the high expectations that we have placed on them. Or you do have another option if this all sounds too woo-woo to you. You can choose to execute some or all of the high-functioning organizational and leadership traits I've described over the last 15 minutes, or you can choose to do the opposite. You can be that narcissistic leader we've all had in our past, which, by the way, most of us took our talent somewhere else, likely because of those leaders. You can choose to demean, criticize, hire a bunch of yes men and women, under-communicate, chase that talent out of the building when they get too good for you. You can fail to recognize their innovation. You can undermine their trust. You can keep your employees beneath you and never give them a chance to grow and innovate. You can drive performance through intimidation, through fears and threats. And there's actually a long list of successful sociopath CEOs. But at the end of the day, you need to decide. You need to decide what type of leader you will be, what type of business you want to work on and in every day. And you get to decide what your legacy is going to be. So decide. This is Dallas McLaughlin, and that was another episode of Unconsidered. If you made it this far, thank you so much. That means a lot to me. If you're interested, there's links to all of the research and a full episode transcript at my website, dallasmclaughlin.com. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a review on your podcast platform of choice and consider sharing it with a friend of yours. Until next time, keep working hard and have fun.